The roundup of the usual suspects continued in the days following the murder. A total of 21 men gave fingerprints and samples of either hair or saliva. On December 16th, Detective Smith and Agent Rogers drove to the OSBI crime lab in Oklahoma City and delivered the evidence taken from the murder scene, along with samples taken from 17 of the men. The 4-inch square of sheetrock was the most promising piece of evidence. If the bloody print had indeed been left on the wall during the struggle and murder, and if it did not belong to Debbie Carter, then the police would have a solid lead that would eventually take them to the killer. OSBI agent Jerry Peters examined the sheetrock and carefully compared its markings with the prints he'd taken from Debbie during her autopsy. His first impression was that the prints did not belong to Debbie Carter, but he wanted to review his analysis. On January 4th, 1983, Dennis Smith submitted more fingerprints. On the same day, the hair samples from Debbie Carter and from the crime scene were given to Susan Land, an OSBI hair analyst. 2 weeks later, more crime scene samples landed on her desk. These were cataloged, added to the others, and placed in a long line to someday be examined and analyzed by Land, who was overworked and fighting a backlog of cases. Like most crime labs, Oklahoma's was underfunded, understaffed, and under enormous pressure to solve crimes. While they waited on results from the OSBI, Smith and Rogers plowed ahead, chasing leads. The murder was still the hottest news in Ada, and folks wanted it solved. But after talking to all the bartenders and bouncers and boyfriends and late-night characters, the investigation was quickly settling into drudgery. There was no clear suspect. There were no clear leads. On March 7, 1983, Gary Rogers interviewed Robert Jean Deathridge, a local. Deathridge had just completed a short stint in the Pontotoc County Jail for drunk driving. He had shared a cell with one Ron Williamson, also locked up for a DUI. The jailhouse chatter about the Carter murder was rampant, with plenty of wild theories about what happened and no shortage of claims of inside knowledge. The cellmates talked about the killing on several occasions, and, according to Deathridge, such talks seemed to bother Williamson. They argued often and even exchanged blows. Williamson was soon moved to another cell. Deathridge developed the vague opinion that Ron was somehow involved in the murder and suggested to Gary Rogers that the police concentrate on Williamson as a suspect. It was the first time Ron Williamson's name had been mentioned in the investigation. 2 days later, the police interviewed Noel Clement, one of the first men to volunteer fingerprints and hair samples. Clement told the story of how Ron Williamson had recently visited his apartment, supposedly looking for someone else. Williamson walked in without knocking, saw a guitar, picked it up, and began discussing the Carter murder with Clement. During the conversation, Williamson said that when he saw police cars in his neighborhood the morning of the murder, he figured the cops were after him. He'd had some trouble in Tulsa, he said, and he was trying to avoid more of it in Ada. It was inevitable that the police would find their way to Ron Williamson. Indeed, it was odd that it took them 3 months to question him. A few, including Rick Carson, had grown up with him, and most of the cops remembered Ron from his high school baseball days. In 1983, he was still the highest draft pick Ada had ever produced. When he signed with the Oakland A's in 1971, many people, certainly including Williamson himself, thought he just might be the next Mickey Mantle, the next great one from Oklahoma. But the baseball was long gone, and the police now knew him as an unemployed guitar picker who lived with his mother, drank too much, and acted strange. He had a couple of DUIs, one arrest for public drunkenness, and a bad reputation from Tulsa.